the path to a fascistic politics out of the White House and Congress and much of the judicial branch because of the failure of corporate Democrats to defeat Republicans or have decent policies. So this is, as I said at the beginning of our discussion, this is a field of struggle. Let's struggle to change the Democratic Party. That's the only way next year and in 2028 to defeat this fascistic Republican Party.
Norm Zalman, we thank you for being with us, director of Roots Action, author of the new book, The Blue Road to Trump Hell, How Corporate Democrats Paved the Way for Autocracy. And we'll link to your piece in Common Dreams and The Guardian. That ends it for our show. Happy birthday to Dennis McCormick. Happy News Year. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Another politician sitting far away. This is the battleground.
Hi, I'm Jeff Rosenberg. Tune in to the Song Circle every Friday afternoon at 1:30 p.m.
Turn their backs on the grisly scenes, traced to the privileged sons.
And your death will come soon.
You never know what you'll hear next.
It's really exhausting to hear nothing but bad news, including on this show. But today's will be a little bit different. We have some very good news sweeping across the country. I'm Bert Cohen, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive.
He's not breathing.
Can you get a pulse?
Barely.
As one of millions of traditional patriotic Americans who follows, and in my case, reports on the news, I find that it does get depressing. There's a steady flow of ever more political developments that are consistently going the wrong way toward bold-faced authoritarianism. Today's show will be a bit different, something rather upbeat. We have good news to report and discuss with our guest, Ron Knox. He says, from rural communities to skyscraper-shaded streets of New York and Chicago, being bullied by unchecked corporate power has become the most common experience in America. It's the thread that connects Americans of all walks of life and political persuasions, end of quote. And it's starting to have an effect. The title of his article in The Nation magazine is "The Anger at Corporate Power is Everywhere." It's one of those all too rarely encouraging views on political and cultural trends. Ron Knox's perspective is from the heartland of America, a region we Democrats have been steadily losing, but is absolutely essential if we are to win again. If one looks at the history of the region, there's no reason why we should be unable to capture the imagination and enthusiasm of Middle America. After all, resistance against corporate power is hardly limited to liberals and to the two coasts. In fact, liberals are partially to blame for the growth of the unchecked power of big centralized corporations over and above local decision-making. Donald Trump was tragically and most dishonestly able to tap into this very real, quite legitimate populist anger. But as we'll hear today, anger at corporate power is truly everywhere. And that's good news for a change. Many politicians on the left are channeling this popular uprising into electoral victories. The most glaring example is the proposed imposition of energy and water-guzzling data centers in places which voted for Trump but are now the focus of populist anger and determination in hollowed-out farming towns determined to take back local power from international corporate big dogs. As Knox knows, more and more Americans share the knowledge that our pathways to prosperity are fewer and narrower than they've ever been. People from every corner of this once rich land are fighting back and winning. There's a common and growing anger at the concentrated corporate power that has cut people off from the things they need to survive: housing, healthcare, access to food, and more. People across America are taking their futures into their own hands, end of his quote. Well, this is called real populism, as opposed to the faux populism the orange one sold us in two elections. The people voted for populism, but got oligarchy instead. Now they're pissed. So in that frame of reference, today we have some good news for a change. Our guest on today's Keeping Democracy Alive is Ron Knox, a senior researcher and policy advocate for the Institute for Local Self-Reliance Independent Business Initiative. He's a combined storyteller and antitrust expert. Ron reports on the ways extreme corporate concentration has come to dominate and damage industries throughout the economy. His writing has appeared in The Atlantic, The Washington Post, Slate, The American Prospect, The Nation, and elsewhere. And he's based in Kansas City, not exactly a liberal bastion. Well, if you watch TV at all, you've probably seen ads for new and exciting centers for employment, data centers. Well, to get us started, tell us about what are these data centers and why are people getting so up in arms about them?
Sure, will do. Thank you very much for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here. So, yeah, I mean, I started my story with an example from College Station, Texas.
Right.
But, I mean, I really could have picked anywhere, but...
Yeah, what happened in College Station?
You know, early September, the city has, just a regular city council meeting. And at that meeting, they were going to... They were going to discuss the possibility of greenlighting a 200-acre data center.
Wow.
On a piece of city-owned land, really right in the middle of town, honestly. And it's the kind of project that maybe in some other place and time would have been no problem. You say yes, and off it goes. Except this time, many dozens of folks in College Station, Texas showed up. They packed the chambers, they packed City Hall, and they collectively protested this data center moving into their backyard. And, it was unprecedented turnout for a place like College Station, especially for a development project. And by the end of the hours-long meeting, the city decided that there was too much local resistance to the data center, and they eventually voted down the project. But again, I picked College Station. Really could have been lots of communities around the country.
Yeah, it's so fascinating that when the people speak up in great numbers, it has an effect. It really does matter. People think, oh, my voice doesn't matter. But here is an example where it did matter. And as you say, hundreds of residents showed up in the small city. One of those who spoke out was Jeffrey Herron. What did he have to say? What did the city council end up doing largely based on his words?
Yeah. I mean, I just want to say it wasn't just... Jeffrey Herron, local resident there in College Station. But I mean, again, it was really dozens, almost 80 folks spoke out against this data center. But what Jeffrey Herron said was something that I think is a really common, feeling and experience, not just with data centers, but with lots of different kinds of big corporate activity in communities, is that, if the city is going to do something like this, if they're going to sell off their own property, which is really the people's property,
mm-hmm.
they want that property to do a thing that's going to benefit the community. And that's what Jeffrey Herron told city officials. He said, look, this needs to benefit me and my family and the community. And instead, what seemed to be happening was they were going to greenlight a data center that at the end of the day is simply going to enrich the folks who are building and operating and profiting off the data center with no real public or community benefit. And so, again, like many others, Jeffrey said, we don't want this in our neighborhood. This is not a good fit for our city. And, again, hours later, well after midnight, the city eventually agreed and said no to the data center plan.
So people can make a difference. We've seen these ads on TV from Meta and other big corporations touting how glorious these new data centers are and how good they are for communities. Why do so many people get up in arms about data centers, which the big corporations plan to set up across the country? What do they make and what do they use, these data centers?
Right. Well, I mean, for folks who don't know out there, these data centers are largely being built to help power, the computational power needed for generative AI, artificial intelligence. And there are a handful of companies who are making a lot of money at the moment doing that. But I think the mask is really off for these data centers for folks in communities. It's now become more than apparent, I think, for a lot of different people and increasingly for local officials as well, that these data centers, they set up shop. They are extraordinarily resource intensive. They're the kind of the blueprint for what you think of as extractive corporate power, right? They come into a community and they're using a ton of electricity. In some cases, more electricity than the entire town itself would require over the course of a year, for example. They require an immense amount of fresh water. And aside from the initial construction of these things, they actually create very, very few jobs. For example, this data center in College Station that we were talking about, at the end of the day, it would create 45 permanent jobs while using an enormous amount of resources and putting folks' electricity bills way up. So the mask is off these things. And so you are ending up with this real organic grassroots opposition in all parts of the country, I'll point out. Folk, you know, in places that do not have some great history of, you know, of advocacy around these kinds of issues, liberal, conservative, however you want to call these communities, they all can see right through all of these hollow promises of these data centers, and they're saying no.
So they don't. They claim to be supplying much needed jobs in areas that have been hollowed out. It's not true.
They simply don't do it. I mean, they, you know, logically it makes sense, right? So yes, of course, it requires some amount of employment to build these things. They're often quite large, you know, many hundreds of acres, et cetera. But once that initial construction is done, these are just banks of servers. These aren't, you know, this isn't a factory producing a thing that people are going to use. This, you know what I mean? This isn't productive, you know, industry. You know, these are server banks and they just don't require a lot of people to keep them running. So no, I mean, you know, a handful of dozen jobs, and that kind of low employment is the kind of thing that creates a vacuum in those communities. So there's not the kind of employment that would sustain a bunch of other ancillary businesses like restaurants and shops and whatever else you might have. So it's just purely extractive with very little community benefit.
Well, I'm old enough to have been involved in the anti-nuclear fight when there were construction jobs aplenty, but once the nuclear plant got built, very few employees. Same kind of thing. Big corporate things that make a lot of money for the corporations. But FDR, one of my heroes, kicked off a long era of public utilities, bringing electricity, serving the common good. The Tennessee Valley Authority, for example. Contrast that, if you would, the concept of public utilities and corporate power.
Well, sure. Yeah, no problem. I mean, you know, the contrast is, I think, pretty obvious. When you talk about, you know, public utilities, you're talking about a public resource, a thing that is owned and controlled by, you know, by the public. And there is a, you know, a clear through line between those, you know, that kind of ownership and those kinds of businesses existing and the public good, right? These things are not set up to extract profits or to enrich shareholders or do all, you know, any of those kinds of things. They exist to provide a resource, you know, and wealth to the public. Whereas on the other side of that is that you have things like data centers, things like Amazon warehouses and so on, these very resource intensive private enterprises and communities, whether that resource is water or power or labor or whatever it might be. And they're there simply to extract, ship the profits off elsewhere, enrich the shareholders, enrich the C-suite executives, and often leave the community much worse off. So very different kinds of infrastructure.
So not providing anything really to the local community. How unusual or typical are scenes like in College Station of public resistance to data centers?
They are becoming unbelievably typical, these, you know, these scenes of local resistance to To data centers. And again, at this point, as I said, I really feel like the mask is off of data centers. And it's not just among advocacy communities. It's not just among local folks. It's at the leadership level in lots of different parts of, local government around the country. They look at these things and they say, this is objectively bad for the community. We're not getting anything out of this. We're asked to give up so much, and it's purely to make a handful of very large, very powerful companies wealthier, even more powerful, and we're just going to say no. So, in 3 months alone, in the course of the last year, more than 20 different data center projects were shut down by local opposition. That's worth almost $100 billion in investment. And that window is from the spring and the summer of 2025. And this opposition has only increased as the year has gone on, to the point that now you have Senator Bernie Sanders proposing a nationwide moratorium on data center construction because of its extreme, resource intensive extraction from local communities. So resistance is building.
Well, I know I've seen one or two ads, and it's been surprising to me to see the ads on TV. But what specific corporate interests are behind this drive for these massive new data center structures? In other words, what corporate interests are behind the emerging extractive corporate power? Name names, please.
Sure. Yeah, sure. I mean, happy to. I'm assuming your audience knows a lot of these, these corporate actors well. This is really just a handful of the largest tech companies in America. So we're talking about Amazon, we're talking about Google, OpenAI, which is largely funded by Microsoft, and then NVIDIA, who's the company actually making the chipsets that are operating these these data centers. So again, it's these already very large, very powerful companies simply attempting to enrich themselves even further and consolidate this rapidly expanding AI market and very likely creating a kind of economic bubble in the process of doing that.
If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is called Keeping Democracy Alive. It's been a heavy lift for a long time. We're talking about some good news today, the resistance to data centers. Our guest today is Ron Knox, who's written an article in The Nation magazine, which I hope you all read, called Anger at Corporate Power is Everywhere. And it's building up not just liberals, people all across the country. You say this, the growing collective outcry against corporate control suggests there's something far larger going on. Americans are doing it. And populism has been rising in America for years. This moment feels different. Do tell, please, in what ways? What's different about this moment?
Well, I think the thing that makes this moment different to me is this kind of common enemy, right? I think that there's this confluence of things that are occurring right now in American life that have really set the stage for this kind of newfound broad push towards populism in America. And I think those things are twofold. So sorry, Bert. One, I think, is really the rise, of data centers, and again, we don't need to harp on about that, but I do think that they've become so prevalent and so aggressive in their push to build these new sites all over the country that there is this, all of the geographic lines that might divide folks in America have been broken down because these data centers are trying to attempting to move into every community around the country, regardless of its potential political leanings or anything like that. So there's this, kind of common enemy there. And then there's also this increasing common experience in America of being ripped off, being bullied, having to pay too much for things that just 5-6 years ago were highly affordable. And so you have this kind of, all these different, forces, extractive forces that are pushing in on people, that are really controlling folks' lives. And they're looking, I think people are looking out there and saying, okay, who's responsible for this? Who's responsible for this much worse experience than I'm having living in America, and they're seeing corporate power behind all of it, and it's and they're not wrong. And so it's a different kind of populism than maybe even the kind of, you know, Bernie Sanders Trump dichotomy of 2016 or even 2020. You're seeing this real grassroots visceral anger at the way life in America is going, and it's breaking down traditional political lines.
But in a way, it's sort of backing up traditional lines. You say that the broad backlash against corporate power today bridges partisan lines, as you just said, and channels a philosophy that has been core to America since its founding, end of quote. Say more about that, please.
Sure. I mean, you know, you look back at the history of America, and in some ways, it is really a people's history. Now, I'm not, you know, I'm not talking about the founding fathers. I'm not talking about the aristocracy and folks who had power.
Right, right.
But you know what I mean? But the people's history of America is really this grassroots opposition to the monopoly control of their lives. I mean, the Boston Tea Party was a rejection of the monopoly of the British East India Company over the tea trade, for example, right? And it goes on and on. You look at the anti-monopoly, the original anti-monopoly movement of the late 19th century and early 20th century, and what you can see is this you know, collective opposition to growing industrial power in America in those days. And that resistance was coming from all sides. It was coming from your, you know, agrarian, you know, farmers in the middle of America who were having a hard time accessing, you know, the capital and the finance that they need to run their farms. Resistance of, you know, shopkeepers and others in urban areas who were suddenly, you know, forced to buy their supplies from a smaller and smaller number of increasingly corporate and financialized entities. And then from workers as well, who were often, you know, these were the first folks who...
If you enjoyed that discussion, don't miss a single show. Subscribe. It's all free.
And if you find the information valuable, your friends probably do too. Ask them to also subscribe.
It's on Apple, Spotify, Substack, Progressive Radio Network, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and of course, the website, keepingdemocracyalive.com. Thanks very much.
Who, you know, moved off the farm and moved into cities and were doing wage work, and they realized that their lives were increasingly being controlled by corporate power as well. And so there's this history of this broad kind of populism, again, that really cuts through a lot of geographic and political lines. And it just comes down to the fact that folks' lives were being controlled by corporate power, and they were going to resist it by any means. And that is where a lot of our you know, laws against corporate power, regulations against corporate power came from. It's really the heart and soul. It's really the heart and soul of the New Deal, I think, was this resistance to, you know, the kind of corporate power that allowed, you know, the Great Depression to, you know, to happen. And it really drove a lot of the broad prosperity of the 20th century as well. So yeah, I think it's just part of our history.
It is part of our history, and it goes back to Shays' Rebellion and the Whiskey Rebellion. Who was going to pay for the War of Independence? Should it be the wealthy people? Well, a lot of the farmers and yeomen didn't think so, so they had a bit of a rebellion. And there's a great and long history and tradition of anti-monopoly populism, especially in the Midwest. People haven't heard very much of Fighting Bob La Follette, but I bet you have. In the late 19th century, coastal-based monopoly rallied farmers and rural neighbors. It was the Democratic Farm Labor Movement, which still exists at least in name. Is there perhaps the ghost of the DFL lurking amongst the alienated, angry citizenship today, do you think?
I love that question. I really do, and it's funny because, you know, the DFL is... calls Minnesota home. And you can look at Minnesota today, and the Minnesota Farmers Union, for example, is on the front lines of fighting monopoly power in a lot of different ways. But yes, I think it is exactly the same kind of circumstances that is creating exactly the same kind of broad coalition that's really ready to stand up against corporate power. And if that means bucking their traditional political parties, whether or not a candidate has an R by their name or a D by their name, then that's what they're going to do. Because I think there's this increasing understanding that both parties have for a number of generations been very bad on the topic of corporate power and have allowed corporate power to really grow back into this broad industrial monopolization. And so the resistance to that is almost identical in my eyes to the kind of broad coalition that really, created the first anti-monopoly movement in the Midwest in the first place.
And for many of us, a very long time ago, back when we were in school, we heard something about William Jennings Bryan's famous Cross of Gold speech. No one understood what that meant, but perhaps you do. How does this tie in with the history of populist anger at the concentration of power and wealth, that Cross of Gold speech?
Well, it's really, I think about the circumstances of those days, this sudden increasing financialization of so many industries across the country, really driven by Wall Street. And this understanding that who controls the money controls the power, and that being particularly true in this kind of rapidly shifting industrial life in America. And then you reflect on today, what we see in the economy today, and I mean, if it isn't exactly the same, it sure does rhyme, because we are seeing absolute domination of Wall Street, private equity, and all kinds of investment monopoly capital being thrown around the economy in the attempt to roll up every industry, in the attempt to really control what we produce, who produces it, and then who shall rule, who shall become enriched and powerful in that process. And that's what's facing so many Americans in every aspect of their lives, where they work, how they shop, how they consume their media, et cetera. So so many parallels to those days in our economy and our politics today.
I find it fascinating how many people voted for Trump with a populist feeling. They wanted to take on the big powers that both parties had set up, and they felt that Trump was doing something different. He's doing something different, all right. It's more of he's bringing back feudalism, the old medieval system of just a few rich people controlling everything. Which brings us to the question of, where is the Democratic Party? Are there any current political leaders, aside from Bernie, fairly obviously, it's nice to have somebody dependable like that, any other Democratic political leaders who are genuinely allied with this movement? Do you see any signs of this nascent movement taking over the party, which of late has found itself in the wilderness?
Sure. I mean, it's a great question. I mean, I think there are leaders out there who really, really care about corporate power, who have a good analysis of corporate power and a good understanding of what it would take both politically and functionally to rein in corporate power and to indeed return power to the people. I think of folks like Chris Murphy, the senator from Connecticut, yes, who is really incredible on these issues, extremely smart and really, really dedicated to the anti-monopoly cause. Representative Jayapal, of course, from Washington, who has Amazon in her backyard and knows about corporate power more than potentially anybody, who is the leader of the Trust Busters Caucus there in the House. I think she's really terrific. And then, you look at Mayor-elect Mamdani in New York, and you can see this new breed of politician who who has really experienced life under the thumb of corporate power in a very expensive city, a city where costs are rising really rapidly. And because of that lived experience, inherently understands what must be done in order to make life better in that city. And I think you look at that kind of formula and you extrapolate it out a little bit to the rest of the country, because, you know, as much as folks in Omaha, Nebraska can look at New York City and go, they're not like us, we are different. It's like, yes, you are, but you also are not. You're also experiencing the same kind of, you know, lack of affordability that's really pushed and driven by corporate power, the lack of options in where you work and you know, how much you get paid, et cetera, et cetera. These issues are prevalent everywhere, whether you're in New York or you're in Omaha or you're in, you know, Murfreesboro, Tennessee, or wherever you might be. You're experiencing these same kinds of things. And so you look to leaders like Mamdani and others and you say, okay, this is the perspective that we need if we're actually going to take back power and we're actually going to create a party that is responsive to the needs and the wants of the people and has a realistic understanding of what life in America is actually like today.
So the affordability crisis isn't a Democratic hoax.
It's certainly not. Go to the, anybody who's been to a supermarket or paid their insurance bill or, you know, their phone bill or anything like that over the last 5-6 years knows that it is certainly no hoax. It is a real lived experience of America, unfortunately.
If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. I'm pleased to be talking about something rather positive happening in America for a change, with our guest, Ron Knox, who's written an article in The Nation magazine titled Anger at Corporate Power is Everywhere. And it is everywhere, from New York City to Kansas. It's growing all across the country. This feeling of populism is real. It may have been absconded by Trump, but it's still real. Going back to the Democratic Farm Labor, how did they build the middle class out of the Gilded Age? The Gilded Age was when it's like a junior version of what we have now, quite frankly. Mm. How does that relate to today's challenges and opportunities? How they built a middle class out of the ghost of the Gilded Age?
Well, you know, the rising trusts, as they were called, and yes, industrial powers of those days, again, created this, you know, this populist broad backlash and reinforced this, I think, very American, you know, feeling that we can't, you know, we can have no public or private kings controlling our lives. Uh-huh. And we actually have to deliver power to the people. And that's part of the American promise is that we're going to do that. And so from that feeling, you end up with this kind of politics and this governing philosophy that, you know, started. There was an anti-monopoly party for a very brief period of time in the, you know, late 1800s.
Right.
There was a populist party that, yes, was a little bit more substantial. And then you can really feel those, you know, you can see how the politics of those parties became intertwined and really became part of the fabric of the Democratic Party. And that experience and that understanding of what our values should be informed the response to the Great Depression, the New Deal, the rise of antitrust that we really saw throughout the 30s and the 40s, including the passage of important laws like the Robinson-Patman Act, which was really about economic fairness, and so on. And so with that set of rules, right, that's a rule book. And it's a governing philosophy that was really, you know, the lodestar, the guiding light for, you know, for the party for many decades throughout, yes, the middle of the 20th century. And so what do you have? You have an economy, you know, it created an economy where there was no huge pockets of corporate power. Where there were pockets of corporate power, they were counterbalanced by a strong, vibrant labor movement to add weight to the other side of that scale, so to speak. And you end up with this broad prosperity that really touched, you know, systemic racist, you know, issues aside, there were certainly communities in America like there are today that were, you know, that were left behind, that didn't have the same advantages. The New Deal didn't really help them as much as it helped others.
Right.
But overall, you did have this broad prosperity and this vibrant middle class that rose and remained very, very strong from the post-war period all the way through the 70s until the Reagan Revolution of the early 80s.
So the Democratic Party had that going for it, and it seems to have come to a stop during the Bill Clinton years when he enacted a lot of Reagan's agenda. So the Democratic Party used to be like that. And I won't talk about the universality of what we're talking about here. You talked about, in the beginning, the meeting in College Station. Democrats have not done well in the heartland. Let's face it. I mean, they were ruby red. Tell us about another angry gathering of Midwesterners in Jonesboro, Arkansas, another ruby red district. What happened there?
So this is a fascinating one. I actually love this story. I mean, I don't love it because of what's happening, but I love it because of the moment that it's really capturing. So in Jonesboro, there was this really typical kind of meeting for local farmers to meet with representatives of elected officials, you know, congressmen and senators there at a little meeting hall in Jonesboro. Very typical kind of thing that happens all over the country all the time. And you expect a handful of farmers to show up and talk about, you know, talk about the farm bill and talk about subsidies and all of those kinds of things. Instead of a handful of farmers, 400 local farmers show up at this meeting. This meeting is happening in the middle of harvest season, by the way. And for folks who know anything about agriculture, you know how remarkable this is for people to take time out from actually harvesting their crops to show up at this meeting. And they line up for hours in a parking lot. They sit in the meeting hall for hours.
Wow.
And they are spelling out the doom that is facing, you know, farmers, not just there in Arkansas and, you know, southern Missouri and so on, but really all across the country, if leaders don't do something about a handful of issues. But number one is the corporate control and the financialization of agriculture. If you're a farmer or a rancher, you are surrounded by monopoly power on every side, from the inputs that you have to buy, the seeds, the fertilizer, and so on, the tractors and combines that you use to harvest, and then where you sell into, the markets that you have to sell into, are highly monopolized, highly financialized, all with the goal of squeezing the farmer. Again, it's this extractive philosophy of outsized corporate power. And you're talking about the potential for a generational die-off of small family farms in America if something isn't done about this. So, you know, again, so this resistance to corporate control it's not just data centers. It's not just in you know, very liberal places in the coasts or in big cities. It's really everywhere. And there's this really broad understanding that we have ceded too much control over our lives and our livelihoods to the hands of a handful of very wealthy and powerful corporate interests.
You echo what millions of Americans are feeling, that our pathways to prosperity are fewer and narrower than they've ever been, not just in hollowed-out towns in the Midwest, but in places like New York City. Mondani, is the election of Mondani a good example, or was he an aberration? People say, well, he's in New York City. That's as blue as you can get. Was he an aberration which could only win in solid blue New York City?
No, he's not. I mean, I'm sorry. And I do appreciate what people are saying, and they're not wrong. New York is New York. There's no place like New York. And it certainly is, a very liberal place. But you look at the history of mayors and other elected officials in New York, this hasn't been some bastion of radicalism. Not really. It's actually been from Giuliani to Cuomo. It's honestly been a lot of very centrist folks with a lot of mixed kinds of policies. So whatever you want to say about New York, it isn't historically it hasn't been the kind of place to really full-throatedly lean into a democratic socialist as mayor. The thing that is different now, that again, as I said earlier, this is not just different in New York, this is different everywhere, is this affordability crisis and the broad feeling that we are no longer in control of our lives and our destinies in America. And that feels really, really bad. And so you have folks who are attracted to somebody like Trump, who at times has talked a real populist game, despite what he's actually done while in office. But you also have folks who are willing to listen and be open to people like Mamdani, because they are speaking, they're promising to address the real lived experience of America right now, which is, corporate control, it's unaffordability, it's these massive corporate incursions into our communities and our lives in ways that we don't really want. And anyone who talks that game and is willing to actually back it up, who is willing to govern with that philosophy, is someone that I think is going to be popular in any community around the country, whether it's traditionally red or traditionally blue. I don't think that matters. I think what matters is that you're speaking to what real Americans are actually living through and going through right now, and you have a plan to do something about it.
And part of the problem, let's face it, we all use Amazon. Everybody uses Amazon to one extent or another. Please tell us about worker uprisings and their massive facilities in the context that we're speaking of.
Sure. I mean, everybody does use Amazon. That is what a monopoly is. That's it. Sometimes it is simply unavoidable. The problem is that it's often unavoidable for workers around the country as well. Amazon has really been at the forefront of creating the 21st century company town, where it's an Amazon warehouse. They're the main employer. If you don't want to work for Amazon, good luck. You better be able to pack up your family and move. But oftentimes workers are really stuck in this often powerless relationship with Amazon, as it has grown to become the largest private shipping and storage company in America, larger even than UPS or FedEx. So the response to that kind of, again, this is extractive corporate power in communities around the country. And the response to this, both from workers and from communities, has been exactly what the same kind of thing that we've seen in response to data centers and dollar stores and lots of other businesses, which is, we're going to get organized. Uh-huh. B, we're going to oppose you even being in the community, which we've seen in towns and cities from coast to coast. It's all of these kinds of pockets of people-centered power that is, again, putting weight on the other side of the scale from this massive corporate entity that has been largely unaccountable, that largely gets whatever it wants, if it wants to build a warehouse or if it wants to pay its workers, a poverty wage and like really put them through the ringer in terms of their working conditions. You're seeing resistance to that, and it's happening in labor. It's happening in city halls and county commissions. And it's rising all over the country. And again, I feel like I'm beating a drum over and over again, but it is this broad-based resistance to corporate control in people's lives that we're seeing everywhere. And Amazon is certainly a huge part of that.
We talked a bit about the history of in the 1890s. The two parties that came out of this movement, the Populist Party was one of them. Your article introduced me to something called the 1892 Omaha Platform. I had never heard of that. What was that? How does that relate to America's tradition of longing for populism? Omaha Platform.
That's great. Yeah, no, I love that. The Omaha Platform was, it was really the launch of the Populist Party and the Populist Movement of the late 1800s. And again, I think it really set the stage for so much of the governing philosophy of the Democratic Party that we saw in the early through the mid 20th century. And so the Omaha Platform, the People's Party of America got together. This was at a party-wide meeting in Omaha, Nebraska. And they created this kind of, a manifesto that really that really talked about what the republic should look like, what we expected of our democracy. And that really some really basic kind of tenets of what life should look like. For example, wealth belongs to the person that creates it. And there's this great line in the Omaha Platform that says every dollar taken from industry without an equivalent is robbery. So if any dollar taken away from workers without reason, without productive reason, is robbery. So really getting at the idea that we cannot let the drive for profits and for corporate control be the thing that rules our economy and our political lives in America, and so on. So, it really talked about a safe national currency. It talked about the strength of workers.
Right.
Exactly. Not gold. Exactly. And so on. So, I mean, again, really setting the stage for what would really drive, the New Deal and the governing of the Democratic Party well beyond, the life and eventual demise of the Populist Party.
The Democratic Party had been strong in the 20th century, and you say the prominent centrist belief that the Democratic Party is somehow a tent big enough to contain both anti-monopoly and embrace corporatism is fiction. You also assert that the Democratic tent can and should be big enough to include the vast, diverse American working and middle class and no larger. As a former state senator, I have friends in the establishment Democratic Party who would disagree with what you're saying. Please explain.
Sure. I mean, I think that we've gotten to a point in American life. And again, everything that I write and that I talk about, I'm trying to reflect the experience that people have living in America today. I mean, that's kind of my main thing, right? Like, what are we all doing out here? Like, what's it like working as an Uber driver or an Instacart driver or in an Amazon warehouse or in a dollar store? Like, what is this experience that we're having out here? And I think that at some point, Americans, working Americans, folks in towns all over this country have increasingly drawn this philosophical line that says, this is our community, we are these people. It doesn't matter who they voted for. It doesn't matter if they went out and voted for Trump or they voted for Harris or Biden or whoever, right? They look around, they say, we are the community, we are the people. And there are these other things happening out here that are actively trying to make our lives worse, that are actively trying to push down our wages, our working conditions, make our electric bills higher, make our grocery bills higher, right? Make life worse day by day in America.
And I would agree that.
I'm sorry.
Well, I was going to say, I would agree that is not the Democratic Party. That is not the way to win, to include those interests.
Right. I mean, and that's kind of what I'm getting at, is that you actually have people that are drawing this line in the sand. And when people have drawn this line, and they say this is us and this is them, and we really are gonna fight for our communities, which is what you're seeing all over the country. And then they look out at their political leadership, whether it's Republicans or Democrats, it doesn't matter, but they look out at their political leadership and they see them like acting hand in hand with folks that are trying to open up a data center in their backyard. Right. Or with folks who are trying to open up some exploitive, you know, warehouse or some, you know, some chain store that they don't want. And they see them taking this money from, you know, from these big corporations and turning that money into a campaign ad or into a mailer, right, or whatever, right, it might be. And they're saying, look, we're not like this. We're not going to stand for this. Like, we are not part of this party. We are something else. And I think that that's the moment that we're at today. And I think that anyone who's trying to make, especially the Democratic Party, anyone who's trying to make the Democratic Party a big enough tent to include that corporate power that so many people across the country are actively fighting against and are being actively harmed by, that is a losing scenario. That is the way to lose election after election after election, because you're not really reflecting the lived experience of Americans, and you're not really reflecting what folks want out of their, you know, their leadership, their economy, and their daily lives. So I think that the party cannot be so big that it includes the wealthy and powerful. That's not what's at the heart of the Democratic Party historically or today.
I tend to agree. Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest today is Ron Knox, who is from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. He's written a piece in The Nation magazine, Anger at Corporate Power is Everywhere. What explains why fascism has such appeal to so many whose futures are so bleak and whose problems are not addressed by the Democratic Party? It's a mystery to me.
I mean, is it? I mean, look, I don't think it's unusual now or throughout history for folks who have been marginalized, who have been, you know, subjugated to simply wage work with very little control over their lives. Their quality of life has gone down, sometimes in really noticeable and tangible ways, like the big union factory in their town closed, you know, two generations ago, and nothing ever replaced it. That's bad. That's a bad feeling, right? And so there are so many Americans now who have experienced that and are experiencing that declining quality of life, you know, that they're looking for some kind of answers. They're looking for some kind of thing to blame. And so, and, you know, this is the core problem with the Democratic Party being too big and including wealth and power in the party tent, is that it can't offer, it's never been able to offer a real tangible alternative for those folks to say, here's actually what's made your life worse. It's actually these corporate boardrooms and, you know, shareholder primacy of capitalism and so on. They can't say that because their corporate backers won't let them say that. And so they don't. And so you end up with this void, this vacuum, where people are looking for answers. People are looking for someone to blame for their, you know, for their lives being bad. And the only place they have to turn is this right wing, you know, demonize the immigrant, demonize right. the folks on the coast, demonize
the other,
you know, woke, the other, whatever it might be. That is literally fascism. And that's, that is the state of American politics today. Luckily, I mean, again, this is a happy story, because luckily we're really seeing a change, I think, in at least some parts of, you know, party leadership, and also that's really being driven by this grassroots opposition to, you know, to corporate power around the country. So hopefully that is changing, and hopefully there is a real alternative to this rising fascism that we're seeing today. But you know, the fact that fascism has taken hold in America and in communities around the country, you know, is no surprise, because when you don't have a real alternative, an actual like here's actually who to blame, when you don't have a party that's willing and able to say that, then you end up with the alternative, which is the straw man, which is the scapegoat, and that's how fascism takes hold.
And you suggest that fighting oligarchy means dismantling companies that make up the oligarchy one by one. Wouldn't that really frighten a lot of simple pro-capitalist Americans?
It might. It might. And that, hey, look, you know, I'll be the first to admit that that's, you know, that's a controversial take, but it's not necessarily new. I mean, you know, in the decades of the mid 20th century, when anti-monopoly was really core to the governing philosophy of the Democratic Party, there was this increasing understanding that, like, the elephant in the room, the thing that we haven't yet addressed, yes, we've said no to monopolization. We've said no to you know, cartels, you can't fix prices. We've said no to big mergers and so on. But the elephant in the room were these enormous, very powerful companies that maybe they weren't breaking the letter of the law necessarily, the laws as they're written, but they had the power to really dictate terms in the economy and in people's lives. And there was this increasing understanding and acknowledgement that that is dangerous, that that's not something that, that you know, should really live in this understanding of American life, where we have, you know, economic diversity and equity and opportunity for everyone, you know, to get ahead, to start a business, to work for a fair wage. It was this constant struggle to try to regulate these companies, to try to make sure the labor movement was strong enough to act as a, as a counterbalance.
Sure.
What actually needed to happen, and this was very big for a number of years in the 1970s, what actually needs to happen is there has to be this real deconcentration of the American economy, so that you cannot have these companies that are so big and so powerful that they can dictate the terms of American life to the people or to politicians. You simply can't have it. And I believe that that holds true today, and we're seeing the evidence of that across the economy today.
We're running out of time, but the phrase democratic socialism still scares a lot of middle-of-the-roaders. What about the term economic democracy, do you think?
I love that. I love that term. That, I mean, I get that tattooed on me. That's a great term, because I think it really speaks to what is core. It's a core American value, like economic democracy. This idea that anybody can make it. Anybody can start their business, and there are barriers to entry, but none are created by some larger corporate power that's simply using its power to put their thumb on the little guy and hold them down. That's like antithetical to the American experiment to me. And so when you talk about, you know, economic democracy, I think you're really getting at that freedom and at that liberty that everybody expects and wants. Earn a fair wage for work. Start a business if you want to start a business. Thrive in your community. Serve and be beholden to your community. That, you know, to me is really core to American life. And when we have betrayed those values, as we have for the last handful of decades, that's how we end up in the situation that we are in today, where we're really having to have this level of resistance to corporate power in our lives.
One final question you raise is what we must do. Can we transform this growing movement against monopoly into real power? What do you think? You optimistic?
We have to. We have to. We don't have a choice. We very literally do not have a choice. If we don't resist, and I don't just mean, and you know, look, bless the people who are out there in city halls all over the country fighting these data centers and fighting these Amazon warehouses and the dollar stores and the Live Nation venues and whatever else. If we do not have, you know, if we do not embrace anti-monopoly and resistance to corporate power as a governing philosophy, a philosophy for how we govern ourselves and our communities, there's no turning back from that. The light at the end of the tunnel will really close. And I don't mean to be dramatic, but I think you know, anyone can look across the country and say, okay, we have a lot of bad things happening right now. And we have allowed people to take power who do not have our best interests in their hearts.
But we can do it. We can do it. We've come to the end here.
We can do it, but it takes all of us. It takes organizing. And again, I think for the Democratic Party, it takes having a laser focus on the needs of working people and middle class folks around the country. And that's it. You lean into that and you have a real political future and a real message for people. And that's what people want.
So if people want to read more of your stuff, you can go to something on the internet about the Institute for Local Self-Reliance.
You absolutely can. Go to ILSR.org. Again, I work for the Independent Business Initiative. You can find that on ILSR. And we put out tons of incredible material, research, reports, investigations about the ways that corporate power harm our lives and what we can do and what lawmakers can do, what activists can do to fight back and to regain control of our communities and our lives.
We do have the power. Thank you so much, Ron Knox, for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive, doing a lot to make it happen.